all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And here we are, another program, another Veterans Radio program coming to you Sunday evenings at 5 o'clock right here on Wham Talk 1600, right in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan, the garden spot of the Midwest. That's right. I guess we had a wonderful day yesterday. We had a big soccer game, a worldwide soccer game right here in Ann Arbor, and everybody's so excited. We're really excited right here at Wham, and we're really excited to be in Veterans Radio because I have two fantastic guests today, Mr. Bob Kripke, Ford Motor Company historian. Ford Motor Company historian. Everything that you want to know about Ford is going to be available with Mr. Bob Kripke. He'll be with us. And also in the studio with me, that's right, we have Rosie the Riveter right here in the studio. Ms. Marge Walters. Marge, say something. Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll be back with Marge in just a moment. In fact, we'll be back with Mr. Kripke in just a moment, but we got to do a little bit of housekeeping. So, Dateline, Ypsilanti, Michigan. Next week is going to be Thunder over Michigan. That's right. The big Thunderbirds are going to be coming to Willow Run Airport in Ypsilanti, Michigan at the Yankee Air Museum. Boy, they're really something, too. Hey, I'm looking at my partner. I have to introduce my partner, Mr. Jim Falsone.
Hi, Bob. Good afternoon. You get so wound up on these things, you jump right in. So, yes, next week is the Thunder over Michigan at the Yankee Air Museum. It's going to be a great event to bring the kids out and enjoy.
You know, because we suffer. Hey, man, I mean, what are we going to do? Vacation's coming up. Well, you can come to the Yankee Air Museum because everything is there. You can get up close and personal with static displays of air. They got a B-52. You know how tall that tail is? It's five stories tall. Five stories.
I think anybody who goes out there looks at the static displays or looks at the actual events where the planes are flying will walk away amazed at what they see, both the manufacturing aspect of it, but also just the American ingenuity. How did they ever do that? And we're going to talk a little later with Marge about how they did that.
How they did that. And the Thunderbirds are going to be there. They're flying in on Thursday. Jim and I and Dale will be there to welcome them to the Yankee Air Museum. But the Thunderbirds are going to be there. I saw those folks down in Dayton about 4 years ago. And they do, they come right at each other, canopy to canopy. Huh. Man, it's really something. Flying 800 miles an hour. Thunderbirds, it is thunder. There's a lot of sound. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of airplanes. They're even going to have some reenactors. That's next Saturday, next Sunday, the 9th and 10th Yankee Air Museum. Hey, how can I get more information? Well, you can go to yankeeairmuseum.org. Be sure you do .org. And get all the information that you need right there. And
we have a couple of other ones to talk about, I think.
Go ahead.
The AmeriCorps group is going to have a Veterans Resource Navigation Team event on August 23rd, hosted by VFW Post 9885 in Westland, Michigan. You can get more information by calling 734-306-3554.
Well, I have something coming to Schoolcraft College. By the way, we want to welcome Schoolcraft College as one of our sponsors. Yes, they're going to be one of our sponsors beginning today, but they're going to have something called Boots to Business Reboot, a conference for veterans, and that's going to be August 13th and 14th. And what it is, folks, if you're looking to start a business and you are a veteran, hey, what can I do? Well, you know, you can buy books and probably get or you can have a consultant at about $1,000 an hour. We don't need that either. But you can go to the Boots to Business Reboot at Schoolcraft College, the Vista Tech Center, Tech Center. And you're going to want this phone number, 313. You should always have a pencil when you're listening to Veterans Radio. 313-324-3605. That's the Boots to Business Reboot. It's really something. It's 2 days of very intense very intense work. Everything you want to know about starting your own business, getting it going, the marketing, how you're going to get funding, everything to do with starting a business, and there's no cost for that. That's right. Compliments of your U.S. government. So that's August 13th and 14th. Contact Alan Cook at 313-324-3605. Boots the business. Well, whew. I can't wait. I can't wait to get right now to our guest, and we'll be right back in a second. And this segment was being brought to you by Schoolcraft College. Take it away, Chauncey.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for five decades. So it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
He was a famous trumpet man from out Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft, but then his number came up and he was gone with a draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam.
Ah, yeah, the Andrews sisters, Laverne. Anybody know the other two? Well, okay. If you do have a comment, or you know the other two, Andrews, Laverne.
Yeah. No, that's it. That's yours, Bob. Can't help you.
Oh, wait. Yeah, that's right. I was in high school. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Hey, if you have a question right here on WHAM 1600 Talk Radio, a question for our or a comment for our guest today, please call 844-838-1600, 844-838-1600. We pay the bill, so you can give us a call from wherever, 844-838-1600. Ah, boy, I have been waiting for this, for this particular program, for about 2 months now, 3 months, and Bob Krepke, the historian, Ford Motor Company has a historian. How many people know that? Corporate historian, too. That to tell the story of Ford and the Ford people, the Ford family, and what they did for the arsenal of democracy. Even Mr. Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, that was the term that he used, and he directed that right at Mr. Henry Ford himself. That's right, Henry Ford, the first Henry Ford. And now with me on the line is Mr. Bob Krepke. He's been with Ford Motor Company since 1975. He's written three books on the Ford Motor Company, titled Ford Motor Company, The First 100 Years, also most recently, The Many Faces of Henry Ford. In 2010, he was awarded Strathmore's Who's Who, honoring Bob for his achievements and in demonstration in his profession. He has also served as chairperson of the Michigan Bicentennial Archive Commission. Boy, we couldn't ask for anybody to have more information on this program, and we want to give a big Veterans Radio welcome to Mr. Bob Krepke. Bob, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. That was very nice. Well, yeah, no, I'm very glad to share what information I have.
Well, very glad to have you, and I know you just came back from vacation, and you're giving us your time on Sunday evening here. Bob, let's get back to the very beginning, right from the beginning.
Sure.
Where was Mr. Ford from, and take it from there. Where did he grow up?
Okay, well, this is a long story, obviously, but condensing it down, Henry Ford was from the Dearborn area. It was called Springwells Township back in the early days. And he grew up on a farm, and he had brothers and sisters and a family, mom and dad. His mother died when he was only 12 years old, and he helped his dad on the farm. He was always close to his family. And basically, when he was about 16 years old, he decided he wanted to, you know, go into the big city. That would be Detroit, near Dearborn. And he hitchhiked into Detroit. And his dad actually had helped him get a job at a small tool and die shop. and he started working there kind of comedically. He only worked there 3 days, and the owner said that he wasn't a very good worker and fired him. So he had to go down the street and find another job that might have been prearranged by his dad, because I think his dad kind of wanted him to, you know, find his own job and that. And Henry ended up actually working at a shipbuilding company, the dry dock workers, and learned how to fabricate engines in the old steamships and that. It was pretty fascinating, and he met a lot of people in the industry and that. And then his father wrote him one day and said, "Hey, son, we really need your help back here in Dearborn on the farm." So Henry, being a good family guy, went back to the farm, but he was smart, and he decided that what he'd do is he'd enroll in, back in those days, what was like a university, to take some business courses, drafting courses, and at the same time, he repaired machinery all around the farm that his dad owned, and that he'd help the other farmers and tinkered around, and he kind of gravitated right into this love of machinery, and he thought he always had a gift for that. And later, he came back into the city. He actually met a lady out in Dearborn, Clara, and they met at a square dance at the Grange Hall out in Dearborn.
Which he
and
liked.
And he fell in love.
And he liked square dancing, isn't that correct?
Oh, he loved square dancing all his life, and he promoted it very much. We have a place over at the Henry Ford Greenfield Village called Lovett Hall. And Lovett was actually a dance instructor, Mr. Lovett. And Henry Ford had employed him to promote dancing, all types of dancing. But his favorite was kind of square dancing. And Henry already kind of fancied himself as a fiddle player. So it was kind of interesting. But the rest is kind of history. Henry went back into town with his new wife, and they moved back into Detroit. And he started, he worked for the Edison Illuminating Company. He made pretty good money. And his hobby was tinkering around with these new horseless carriages,
and
gasoline internal combustion engines.
Here is this genius, folks. This man is a genius. He's an engineering genius. But he also had a fervor to help the common man. And tell us about that, Bob.
Well, all of his life, Henry Ford really had a passion for helping those who help themselves. He always believed that if a person wanted to work in that, that it was kind of his responsibility to help him find a job in that. And he did. I mean, there's thousands of examples where he did that. And even when he started his Highland Park plant, he made special arrangements to hire veterans and to hire widows that had lost their husbands and loved ones in the war and that. And he was very sympathetic to that, perhaps because he had lost his own mother, you know, at a young age and that. But he always kind of watched out for those. And underprivileged, he started something called the Ford Trade School. And that school catered to underprivileged children that wanted to learn trades and that. And they could apply, and they had preference over people that, you know, had the capital to be able to afford other schools.
Now, it's my privilege to do this program today because my dad went through the Ford trade program.
He did?
Yes,
oh,
he did.
Fantastic.
Isn't that fantastic? My dad ran a lathe back in Highland Park, folks, before it went into the Rouge. Back in Highland, he made the spokes. He ran them.
Yes.
That
uh-huh.
And my dad went through the Henry Ford Trade School. My mother also worked at Ford's. I worked at Ford. We are a Ford family. We even had a Ford garden plot there on Ford Road. Yes you remember?
Yes.
And
oh, I know all about those. Yes, that was another plan, you know, that was supposed to help get people through hard times and that. And those garden plots, as you know, are kind of in vogue again. They're starting to come back.
Well, another tie-in for Ford Motor Company, Mr. Ford, and veterans is that just what you're mentioning, Bob, I think in Canton, There's a veterans, I think they call it a veterans dormitory that was tied to one of the plants that one of the neighborhood plants that he had, and again demonstrating a concern for our veterans, many years ago, and not just talking about it but putting it into action.
Now,
it is great, and there was also a big naval school that was located on the Rouge Complex.
Now, Mr. Ford was a social engineer. I mean, for
yes.
All right. I mean, I'm going to give it a title. I'm going to give it a tag.
No, that's fine.
That's fine. And we'll get to that in a minute. But here he is with Clara, and he's working and spending his evenings and his off time building the quadricycle, and he made it work.
Yes.
Tell us about that, Bob.
Well, the quadricycle was his first attempt at making internal combustion engine vehicle. And although it was certainly not the first car in America and not even the first car in Detroit, but it was Henry Ford's first car, and it was very early, 1896. And Clara actually early on had helped him with developing the engine. In fact, there's a great story on Christmas Eve. She was cooking, you know, their dinner and that, and he wanted her to come out and hold a little apparatus on the carburetor and drip gasoline in it so that he could make the cylinders fire in that. So she was really a part of the whole thing right from the get-go, and the two of them were great partners all through their lives, and boy, they stuck up for each other through hard times and good times, but Henry was a very unusual person, Bob, as you mentioned. He did always look out for the underdog. Often he was very, very misunderstood. Obviously, at the beginning of World War II, he fought to keep America out of the war, which, you know, was interpreted different ways by different people. And then he had partnered with Charles Lindbergh in 1940 to form the America First Committee, which was basically to keep us out of the war. He didn't like seeing what was happening in Europe, all the turmoil. And that obviously, though, when the war broke out and America declared war, just like he did in World War One, Ford jumped in, you know, with both feet.
Well, let's go back, though. Let's take that. After the quadricycle, he had a couple of failures. And he did have problems getting some backers. So
yes.
I want to take us all the way back to the big race. The
yes.
Big race. Tell us about that, Bob.
Well, the big race in town always took place, and usually there was a British guy named Witten. And Witten always had the fastest car and had a big car. Well, Henry Ford decided that he could beat him because he had won a couple earlier races in the early 1900s, I mean, like 1903, 1906. But this particular race was scheduled, and this one had everybody's eyes looking and everything, and Henry Ford built a car called the 999, named after a locomotive that used to run between up the Hudson River between New York and somewhere else up there, and it was real speedy. It's called the 999. It was the biggest internal combustion engine built at the time, had 8-inch cylinders, and it didn't have any muffler on it, so it kind of deafened the opponents in that they were kind of afraid of it. Henry Ford, was actually afraid to drive his own car and hired Barney Oldfield to drive the car. Anyways, making a long story short, this British guy who always won the races, everybody laid their money on him. The race took off, and Witten from England was leading the race. All of a sudden, this 999 just picks up speed and races around that track and actually laps Witten. We won by like a lap and a half. Henry Ford won that race, and his name got into all the newspapers around the world. And now, like you said, Bob, now the backers, the financial people, now they came out of the woodwork to help this guy and said, this guy's got something good going.
Well, I also heard that the other vehicle broke down too, and the reliability the reliability of Ford and the Ford products. And, you know, folks, that continues to today. Ford Motor Company is very involved in NASCAR, right, Mr. Jack Roush?
And absolutely.
Absolutely. And, you can see that.
And that was always Henry's motto, Bob. Henry's motto was, I want to build a durable, simple, affordable car. And to be honest with you, that's what he stuck with. He never really got into the prestigious cars, the rich cars and that. He always wanted to keep them durable so that the common person had a vehicle to drive. And obviously that's why they always say he put the world on wheels.
And he also painted cars, well, only one color. He said, I'll paint your car any color as long as it's
black.
That's right. And there was a reason for that, too.
Oh, what was that?
Because in 1913, we installed the moving assembly line. And one of the things they learned about the moving assembly line was that black paint dried the fastest. And also, you only had to buy one pigment of paint. So consequently, that's when he made that famous statement about you can have any color you want as long as it's black. So from like 1914 on, they were black. Prior to that, they were colors. And in the late 20s, just before the Model T phased out, they went back to painting them different colors. But during the heart of the Model T, they were black.
Well, now, here is this genius. And by the way, folks, it started in Highland Park. If you're ever traveling to Michigan, or those of you in Michigan, you can go to Highland Park, and the factory building is still there. There's been some talk about gentrification and bringing that forward. Has there been anything moving on that in Highland Park?
Well, the Highland Park is very complicated, Bob, because at the moment it's got a lot of hazardous areas, meaning it's been obviously standing vacant. It's been used pretty much as a warehouse. Actually, Ford does not own that facility. Another company owns it. We rent space as general storage in there. And yes, there has been talk about that. It obviously is a famous Albert Kahn designed building, the Crystal Palace, as they called it, because it had all glass on the roof to let the sunlight in. And they were on louvers, so you could open them to let air in there also.
Now, folks, we're gonna kind of skip forward and go to a little bit more about Mr. Ford and his social engineering. But was he a Quaker or a Mennonite, Bob?
Henry Ford?
Yes.
No, Henry Ford was not. He was kind of a mixture. His parents had come over, actually, or his ancestors from Ireland. They had come over from Ireland. He had been a couple things, Presbyterian, Methodist. But to be honest with you, nobody has ever said that Henry Ford was much of a churchgoer. He kind of did his own thing. And definitely believed in God, but had his own ideas about that.
Did he cuss?
No, not at least I have not ever come across any in his diaries or his reminiscence and other people's reminiscence. No, I mean, but you know, Bob, that it was a different era back then. You know what I'm saying?
You know,
and obviously some people cussed. But people that were running companies, even way back then, they were very careful, you know, and did not.
That was the point I wanted to bring out, because smart people and folks that are into heads, they don't need all that. Jim, you have something.
Yeah, Bob, I wanted to ask you. You mentioned that he wanted to keep America out of the war.
Yes.
Was it because he was a pacifist, or just other thoughts about this?
He was. I believe you could say he was a bona fide pacifist, but it stemmed from the fact that he was really mad that we did not literally feel in World War One at the end of the war that we did not stop the turmoil in that, and that we let almost the same thing happen again. He was infuriated that we let Europe get out of hand again, and you got to remember, by the time World War One or World War Two rolled around, Ford, we had facilities in all of those European countries. So everything went topsy-turvy.
So his concern was really that here we go again is what was sort of trying to drive him to stay out of the war?
That, and also he was very, as we said earlier in the program, he was very concerned about people's lives and that. And he thought, what a waste, and an awful lot of innocent people get hurt. Having said that, he was an American through and through, and when we declared war both times, World War I and World War II, as you know, he was the first one
now,
to support it.
Now, okay, here we are. And the mood of the country was, we're not going to go to Europe and fight another European war. So
And
we have about a minute before the break. So I do want to make this point, but along came December 7th, 1941.
Yes.
That changed everything.
And it did change everything, and probably, Bob, it even had that not happened as a big shockaroo, obviously we probably would have got into the war anyways because there were all these reports coming back of the atrocities that were taking place in Europe from the war. I mean, you know, that war, when you start talking about it, and I know we've got less than a minute now, but that was a very complicated, we had so many fronts because, remember, we were battling the Germans. The Russians,
Bob,
got in on part of it.
Bob, I've got...
Japanese was the final blow.
Bob, I'm going to have to go to Bob, I'm going to have to go to a break. We'll be right back.
This is the Blaze Radio News. I'm Ken Stevens. Texas Governor Rick Perry saying unaccompanied kids who come into the U.S. illegally are a side issue.
What we are substantially more concerned about in the state of Texas, and I will suggest to you across this country, are the 80% plus of the individuals who don't get talked about enough that are coming into the United States illegally and committing substantial crimes.
Perry telling Candy Crowley on CNN State of the Union that since September of 2008, more than 200,000 illegals have been booked into Texas county jails alone. Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio used to favor comprehensive immigration reform. Now he believes the piecemeal approach is better.
We're not debating what to do. We're debating how to do it. And I'm just telling you, we will never have the votes necessary to pass in one bill all of those things. It just won't happen. So our choices are we can either continue to beat our head against the wall and try a process for which we'll never have the support, or we can try another way that perhaps we can make progress on.
Rubio on Fox News Sunday. As for the illegals already here.
The president once again threatening to act alone on the immigration crisis, and many blame him for turning a blind eye to the flood of illegals flocking to the U.S.
There's a rising anger among the American people as they see the flood of these immigrants coming in. No attempt to check them out. Just open the borders, let them come, spreading them all over the country. You've got Democrat governors who are unhappy about it. This is just blowing up in his face like a cigar.
That's former Republican Governor Mike Huckabee on Fox News.
The Blaze Radio's Brad James. Israel military confirming it's pulled most of its ground troops from the Gaza Strip after destroying most of the tunnels it says were dug to attack Israel. Heavy fighting still raging, though, in parts of Gaza today. Both the U.S. and the U.N. condemning an attack near a school serving as a U.N. shelter. The Palestinians blaming an airstrike by Israel. This is news on the Blaze Radio Network. Truth lives here.
Applebee's Restaurants is a proud sponsor of Veterans Radio. For the best in family dining, you'll want to make any Applebee's restaurant your destination for just plain good food, good service, and complimentary military discounts. So plan your next delicious out-to-dinner meal at Applebee's. That's Applebee's Restaurant. They help Veterans Radio deliver our program to you.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Mopping up soda pop Ricky's to our heart's delight.
That's a two-swing real quickies, jukebox Saturday night.
Goodman and Kaiser and Miller.
Ah, nice job. Good job on that one, Derek and Nina. Yeah, Jukebox Saturday night. Oh, Bob. By the way, that's the only time we're going to have to hit the mark. So other than the end of the program, we pretty much going to be winging it. So, Bob, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you again for being with us in our arsenal of democracy. Let's go right now, right back to that moment. I believe it was the Secretary of War that took Mr. Ford out to a dusty little small airport in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and said, can you build a plant here that can make B-24s? And Mr. Ford said, yeah, I can do that. And he says, you got 6 months to do it. He said, I'll do it. And he did it. He brought his engineers, his architects. He even set up a sawmill to cut all the oak trees and cut them into beams and made hang. Tell us all about that, Bob.
Well, I always tell people that the B-24 Liberator bomber and the plant that it was built in is a Ripley's Believe It or Not story. And it really is. It's pretty incredible, you know. GM was the largest defense contractor, and Curtis Wright was second. Ford Motor Company was the third supplier of war goods during World War II. However, our B-24 is what the whole nation kind of keyed in on, because we were going to lose the war if we didn't have air support for all of our ground troops. And that B-24 bomber was the thing that they needed. And the bottom line was everybody was bidding on that. You know, Consolidated, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, all the airlines were kind of bidding on this. And only Ford said, hey, you know what? We are going to build this with an integrated aircraft assembly line. We're going to build a factory where we build these things just like we build the cars. And it's amazing. You know, it was named after a little stream out there that ran through the property called, you know, Willow Run. And it was farmland. It was owned outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan. In the 1930s, we planted soybeans out there in that area. But the plant was nearly a mile long when we built it. And as you said, we built it in less than a year, amazingly enough. And we did all kinds of unbelievable things. It was the largest industrial structure in the world under one roof, designed by our good old friend Albert Kahn. It was his largest and his last project that Albert Kahn worked on. But the plant itself incorporated just unusual techniques to put these planes together, to try to get them built under a week in time. And in a minute, I'll tell you how many we finally built. But the bottom line is, we even went out to circuses and carnivals and hired little people because they could crawl in the wings and do the riveting and that. And that sounds like a goofy story in that, but they really became a part of the workforce. We hired about 400 of these little people, and I've read their reminiscence, and they all remarked that it was the first time they'd ever been treated like human beings. They got the same pay. They rode to work. Remember, that was a long ways away from a city in that out there in Ypsilanti. And obviously, I-94 was built to get people out there to work. These little people really played a great part in putting this plane together. Bottom line is the Ripley's Believe It or Not story. We got it down to building one plane an hour. So many planes that we didn't even have pilots to get them out of there. So finally we had to take the wings off them and put them on rail cars and send them to the different coasts that they needed to be at. But it's an amazing story. And, of course, this is enter the time zone of the Rosie the Riveter.
Oh.
And that's a tremendous piece of the story. Most of the men, a lot of capable men, were called in the draft. They were over fighting. So we had to figure out a way to bring in a different type of labor force.
Folks in the business, they call. Jim, you have a question.
I do, and maybe you can give us some sense of size here, Bob, by telling us a little bit about what it cost to finance it, how big the workforce was. We've got this picture in our mind that this is a mile long.
Sure.
But give us some more of those.
Well, originally, to build this thing, they got a quote for $200 million to build the plant and the equipment to produce these planes. By 1941, there was a revision made by the government and Ford, and it totaled about $480 million. That was still way under what anybody thought you could possibly do something like this for. In those days, it was almost considered a blank check because it was so astronomical. But then again, to be honest with you, the freedom of America relied on that product, the B-24 bomber.
And when they were, Bob, when they were designing this, Bob, are they saying you've got to hit a plane an hour? How many plane? What was the production?
No. I believe we originally quoted that we believed we could do one every 4 days.
Oh, boy.
That was the original thing, and that still beat our competition by about 5 days.
Okay. They had to be built. Somebody had to build them. And
yes.
that left now our honored guest right now looking at me across the table, getting ready, is Ms. Marjorie Marge Walter. She's from Superior, Wisconsin. She came to Ypsilanti at the suggestion of her brother, all the way from Superior, Wisconsin, to get
a job,
and she was hired as a riveter. And B-24s, she was riveting and bucking in the center wing area of the B-24. She knows all about it. Marge Walters, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much.
Now, Marge, you and I spoke a little earlier. This is Jim, and you told me you worked at the Stove Works factory before moving over to Willow Run.
Yes.
Tell us about what you got paid at Stove Works and what you got paid at Willow Run.
We got 40 cents an hour when I worked at the Stove Works, and when we went out the bomber plant, we got $1 an hour on days and $1 and a $5 and afternoons and midnights.
Now, folks, Rosie the Riveter, was there a Rosie the Riveter? Probably not. It's a character's composite. There we are. And again, a real Rosie the Riveter is right here with me. Bob, if you have any questions that you want to ask Marge, jump right in at any point, okay?
Well, I was just going to say, Marge, I'm so proud of you. I tell stories all about the people that worked out there at that plant that saved America, honestly. And Marge, just as the men that were over there fighting, you guys really, really did a tremendous job in that. And I probably have pictures of you working there in the midsection of the wing, doing your riveting and that. But congratulations. You did a great job, and probably not enough is said.
Now, part of this, folks, remember, Marge came down here to get some money. We needed some money, and she came down here for a job. I don't know necessarily if it was to save America, but of course it did later on. But here she is, folks. Remember, this is a male-dominant industry in general, miners, workers, farm, what, was all male. Here comes Marge Walters. Oh, boy, how tall are you, Marge?
I was 5'3" and a half when I hired him.
And just full of sand and vinegar, folks. She's coming in here. She interviews for the job. She gets hired as a riveter. She went to riveting school. Tell us about that, Marge.
Well, yes, I went to riveting school. They had the different kinds of schools out there for the different jobs. But the day I was in rivets, one of the days I was in rivet school, President Roosevelt come through. He was the I-94 was being dedicated from Detroit to Willow Run Bomber Plant. And so we got to see him, and it was so hot that day. Oh, it was hot.
Oh, there were fans everywhere, right?
Oh, yeah.
And water coolers.
Air conditioning,
yes. So you're in this, your first day. The noise is deafening. There just were not a whole lot of safety features. Let's get the power of the plant. And there you walked in Tell us about that. What was your thoughts?
Well, I was flabbergasted because it was so huge and so big, and I didn't really know what to expect. But I was welcomed by everybody, men and women.
You didn't get any side glances?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
So one of the things we talked about, Marge, earlier was the day you started, you remember what wing number it was?
I don't remember exactly, but they numbered the wings, and I was, when I started, we were in the 30s, but I don't remember just which, what number it was.
And it finished?
With 8,000.
8,000. And there you were a riveter. What's a riveter and what's a bucker?
Well, the riveter is the one that holds the rivet gun, and the bucker has a metal bar, and he or she backs it. They put the rivet through the hole, and they buck it to flatten it out so it's permanent.
So it's permanent. Now, remember, folks, this is a lot of noise. And I was always amazed, and Marge, this is a question. Here you have somebody on the other side of a skin of an airplane, and there you are, and you really can't have visual. You're not visually in communication, and yet you have to have this coordinating between the riveter with the rivet and the bucker who's making the head on the other side. Mm-hmm. How did you choreograph that?
Well, the riveter put the rivet in and started riveting, and you just buck it because there was the next hole around there wasn't any really other sense of it.
Did you happen to work, Marge, with the same person on a daily basis?
Part of the time. I had male partners, I had female partners, and different ones. They'd come and go.
And we were talking about, tell us about the uniform you had.
Oh, it was a blue uniform, and it was a very tight woven, and it didn't let any air in.
Oy.
No circulation. It was terrible hot. And it was hot out there because they had no cooling system.
They had nothing.
And,
No. And in the plant, were you at the first half of the plant or the first quarter mile? Where were you in the plant?
I was kind of in the, pardon me, in the beginning of the plant because I was in Department 937 horizontal, center wing horizontal, and the vertical come first, and then it come down on the conveyor, and we were in there, and we'd get up under there where the bed, when it was in 936, they would be on each side of it.
Were there when the men welcomed you? Now you said you had a positive welcoming. And but there must have been, or can you recall of any incidents? And again, folks, I'm not looking for any controversy here. I just want to paint this picture of, I mean, it was not our culture. Women were in the home, and men did the work. This was changing, huge. This is a tectonic shift of culture. And Marge, how old were you?
I was about 19, 20.
19 years old, coming from Superior, Wisconsin, if you all know where that is. I was way up there, man. I mean, you know, like they get some long winters there. And she comes down here all 5'3", goes to work with men. And how heavy? Do you recall how heavy that rivet gun was?
No, we had smaller ones because we did smaller rivets. So it wasn't that terribly heavy. I don't remember just how heavy
right,
it was.
But hauling that thing around 8 hours a day and feeling that vibration had to do something.
Well, we didn't rivet 8 hours a day. I mean, we did certain things, certain jobs, and certain little panels or something on, and we did other things too. I mean, we weren't riveting constantly all 8 hours.
One of the things you mentioned also, Marge, when we talked earlier, is that you'd work an 8-hour shift, but not always the same shift. Why don't you explain how that worked?
Well, we swung 8 hours days, 8 hours afternoon, and then 8 hours midnights, and then back on days again. And
was there any indication why that was?
No, I don't recall of any.
Yeah, to have that swing shift like that. So you had to deal with 30 days here and 30 days, and you had to keep track of that. You had, and of course you drove your Ford. No, you didn't drive a Ford. What did you do to get to the plant, Marge?
Took the bus. And sometimes that bus was so loaded they'd get up. There wasn't any safety rules back then. They'd get up in the luggage compartment and lay down so they could get in the bus.
So maybe we can ask our Ford motor historian, Bob, how many men and women worked at the bomber plant during this period? Maybe you can give us some sense of who else Marge was working with.
Well, at the way it was divided out is we were very aware that it was one of the first times on a big scale that we were mixing up the workforce in the female and male workers in that now. And Marge, you'd be able to verify this, but I believe you had your own naturally locker rooms and stuff like that. I believe you shared the cafeteria though, and everybody ate in kind of a centralized place. And that was like an unbelievable thing too, to feed all these people, because at the height of employment, I believe we had 48,000 people working out there, which is incredible.
48,000. Tell us about that, Marge, your experience.
Well, of course, we were not allowed to change departments without permission. And so we didn't get to see too many different people, and only the ones you worked with every day. And some of us took our lunch and ate
right
there in the department.
And folks, if the Yankee Air Museum, well, again, thunder over Michigan this weekend, the Yankee Air Museum has a display of Rosie the Riveter, and it happens to be Marge. Yes, they did a caricature. They took a photograph of Marge when she was a riveter back then and had the mannequin company make the mannequin and the face to be Marge's face. So when you go there, and in fact, Marge did not know that until today, and I found that out from the Yankee Air. I mean, you're going to be forever. It's going to be there, Marge. But you can go there and you can see her in almost live in her blue uniform and the babushka, right? Did you have one of those?
Oh, yes. We had to keep our hair tied up, so it was for safety purposes, of course. And we couldn't wear jewelry, rings, or anything.
Now, Marge, let me ask, how did you feel working there? Did you sort of feel that you were really part of the bigger war effort? What sort of you and the other gals who were working, how did you feel about that?
Yes, we felt we were helping out. And I happened to meet my husband there under the wing there when we were
under
working.
The wing.
Whoa. We're going to have to do a whole other segment on that.
Under the wing.
He was on the hydraulics. I was on the electrical department.
Oh, yeah.
And he went to war, and he wrote back and said that how thankful that the guys over there were that we were back there working.
Now let me just say something else, folks. The quality of this of the work that was done was extraordinary that these women did. These rivets did not come apart on those airplanes. And yeah,
Bob, that was one of the features that helped win the war for America and the Allies, and that was the fact that that's why I told Marge, and I mean this, that you did a tremendous job, because there wasn't a person that stepped in those B-24s that didn't know that they had all of the quality and ingenuity that everybody back home was putting into that plane. And it's tremendous. You know, I read an article in the New York Times from back then, and it said, the Empire State Building is the greatest, most vibrant place for a vertical building, but the Willow Run plant was the greatest horizontal building in the world and had the greatest workforce.
I want to ask a question of Marge, and by the way, all these accolades are well deserved. We are so honored to have you here.
Thank you.
And that there was, Henry Ford was a pragmatist. Yes, he was, folks. That's right. One color, right? One paint, and et cetera, et cetera. But that he turned that plant, the last eighth of a mile was turned 90 degrees. And Marge, tell us why he did that.
Because there's taxes being built in. And he wanted to get out of paying taxes for it.
So Bob, is that story that we hear true from the historian
that
standpoint?
You can count on it. That is absolutely sure. We had to make an L-shaped building because it would not. We didn't want it to go into Washtenaw County, which had brought larger taxes.
Wayne County or Washtenaw?
Wayne
County, I think.
We didn't want to go beyond Washtenaw County.
Yeah.
Marge, there you are now. You've met your... Did you get married while you were working at the plant?
No. He went away, and he was in the war. And when he got discharged in October of 45, and we were married in February of 46.
And you had 10 children? No.
No, six.
Well, that's a lot at the dinner table. You had six, and how many grandchildren?
18.
18. And great-grandchildren?
Nine. 10 in October.
And very quickly, what's the mother's name? The one who's going to have the baby. What's her name?
Julie.
Julie's going to have a baby. Well, you'll have to let us know so we can let the listeners know. That'll be number 10, great-grandchild. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy, you got something.
Marge, when you were working, you knew you were supporting the war effort. Did you realize that maybe the workforce was also changing things for all your daughters and granddaughters and women to come?
I didn't think too much of it at that time, but it did absolutely change it.
And we have some granddaughters of the women who worked in the plant here as well, and they've shaken their heads and gone, "Yes, I know it was a big thing that my grandmother did that," and I think have your kids sort of acknowledged, "Geez, Grandma, I can't believe that was you."
Yes, and they're very proud of the fact that I was out there too.
You know, so. It was, folks. It was a tsunami that came on because at the end of the war. Okay, you can go to the kitchen now, dear. No. No. Now you're going to keep them down on the farm when they've seen Willow Run and everything that it buys and Ypsilanti and all the day. Did you go to dances in Ypsilanti?
Not really. I'm not a dancer.
No, but what was the atmosphere? Was it festive in a way that you all were? I know that there were things that were rationed out, but was there picnics? To tell us about that.
Yes, the people I rode with sometimes, we would go couple of times we went roller skating out the roller rink out on Ecorse Road, and then we went ice skating on the river one time, and now the river doesn't freeze over enough to freeze.
And Bob from Ford Motor Company, were there efforts taken to keep employee morale up? Obviously, it was a good pay.
Absolutely. That was one of the things that we knew. We knew that would be a difficult thing. And we had our own entertainment center out there at Willow Run. And Margaret probably knows more about this than I do. But we had entertainers come out there, and we had a broadcasting network out there and broadcast at certain times in the cafeterias and that. And also you could pick it up on a radio, you know, for several mile radius, and it was the news of Willow Run, you know. And like I said, the whole world, the whole free world, focused their attention on that Willow Run plant. That was the great hope during World War II. And I'm amazed myself, and for all the men and women that worked there, boy, big kudos because that they did it, and amazing.
Well, we want to thank Bob and Marge for being on our program today. We also want to thank our sponsors, Legal Help for Veterans, Applebee's Restaurant, Lynn Pitlack, CPA, Schoolcraft College, and the folks at the Canton Community Foundation, the summit that's coming up in Livonia. It's going to be free to veterans, the fifth annual summit, September 10th. You're going to want to mark that down. And we'll be talking more of that in subsequent weeks because we kind of left things a little, skipped over some things, but we have such important guests today. Jim, you have a last comment?
Well, I think this is, again, all of us at Veteran Radio's March just want to thank you for what you and your colleagues and friends did. I think Bob Kickey's really pointed that out, and all we can do is echo it.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very proud to be able to do it.
Oh, and there's the music. The band's already shown up. My gosh, it's an hour go fast. And I understand that there's something coming up next year. Is that true?
Next year would be the 70th anniversary of World War II, and you can find out more information about that on thespiritof45.org. They're going to recreate the kiss that happened in Times Square.
Oh, yes. And there's also going to be the Yankee Air Museum is taking the last eighth of a mile of the Willow Run plant, turning that into their new headquarters, which should be fantastic.
I just want everyone to know Marge's work is not done. She has been instrumental in raising awareness for SaveTheBomberPlant.org to help.
Wow. There's another program in the can.
You.
And we want to thank all of our guests. 6, 4, 3, you are dismissed. Until next week.